So I was just using Telnet for work.
Telnet. Wikipedia. Protocol used on the internet or local area network to provide...
Wait, really?
Bidirectional interactive text-oriented communication facility using a virtual terminal connection.
Are you serious right now?
I was just helping our listeners out for the ones that didn't know what a Telnet was.
All right, we'll go with that. Yeah, it's like SSH, but way less secure. And back in the day... I needed a way to remotely debug our some of our server processes that we run for remote ham radio in Ruby. So I made a little Telnet server that sits there and listens on localhost. And so if you SSH in the box, you can Telnet to localhost. And it basically drops you in a pseudo prompt that runs within the context of like the application itself, kind of like having an IEX prompt that's like attached to the running application, you know. Mm-hmm. But it does this over Telnet, and it doesn't have any fancy thing. It doesn't have read line. You can't, like, you can use backspace, but you can't use up arrow. You can't, you know, there's no history, there's no search. It's literally just like typing commands and executing them. And you know what has gotten me out of so many binds? Just having that escape hatch, being able to debug and get in there. I should probably like use something like Pry or something proper. But man, a stupid little Telnet server just continues to freaking work.
Just your little backdoor, your little backdoor.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool. I'm thinking, there hasn't really been any amount, like any times that I can recall where I've used like Heroku's console a few times, but I haven't ever come across a need to do that yet. Thankfully.
Yeah, this was important because like I couldn't just launch the application again and run IRB or whatever because, you know, I had to view the state and access the application itself while it's running, you know.
Right. I gotcha. That makes sense. That's cool. Neat little trick.
And I use heavy use of instance eval, which is a method on all objects that lets you run arbitrary code within that object itself, even private and protected functions and variables and everything that you can't normally access. So I end up using that to dig into the internals.
Instance eval sounds like an email subject line I've got before on like some sort of security disclosure.
Oh yeah, you should never use it.
Instance eval. This is cool. I'm learning a lot of stuff today.
So for example, we just had a amplifier that disappeared from the console, and I guess I don't have a button to like turn it on because when it's off it kind of disappears, and I guess the controls I don't have show up. So normally it's on, but right now it's off, so I had to go Telnet in, SSH in, Telnet in, and tell it to turn on, and it just showed right up. I gotta fix that UI.
It's so funny to me because it seems like you spend so much time doing things that I just have never done before. Or like had to have to thought about.
Nor should you want to. It's too messy, dude.
Is it?
It gets very messy. Dealing with hardware, dealing with protocols that are not well documented, dealing with serial devices that are flaky, dealing with RF, literally like blowing out your USB hubs and network connections and all this crap. Dealing with, and by RF I mean like, you know, ham radio transmitters, right? We're having a station issue right now where if we turn the antenna and point it towards the house and we transmit, the whole site just disappears.
What?
Because the RF totally whacks out the Ethernet.
That is pretty wild. Yeah, I am building just as generic as it gets a web app, I suppose. So yeah, something goes wrong. I have no in-memory state to worry about. I have no sort of like hardware issues to deal with yet. Just kick the server over. I can't tell you how many times Paul or I have like noticed something weird, and then in the Slack, one of us will just be like, I'm going to kick the server over. And so you just do a new deploy on Heroku and things are fine.
That reminds me of, what was it called? Shotgun? No, it's not called Shotgun. There was something that existed for some web server where basically it would just kill the web server after X number of days or hours or minutes or whatever, just to prevent the memory usage from climbing too much. It would just kill the server and restart it on an interval.
There's been a number of them. I specifically remember one for Puma for Rails, Puma worker killer. I think if I Googled that, I could probably find it. But actually, for quite a while, there was a memory leak with Nuxt in our production app, and it seemed like on GitHub, a lot of people were kind of running across it, and no one could really figure out what it was. Some people were pointing to Axios, like a memory leak in Axios or something. But yeah, so nevertheless, there was a memory leak, and we used, I'll put a link to the show notes, but yeah, so it was basically just this thing that watched the memory usage, and once it got over a certain threshold, it just restarted. And luckily, we didn't notice too many issues with that. So we were worried about, like, what happens if someone's on the site and they happen to be like hitting a page at a certain time that the worker gets kicked over, right? So it interrupts their connection or something. But we didn't really notice any issues. So we had it like that in production for a while. And then one of the Nuxt versions just fixed the memory leak, and it's been fine ever since. So I just pulled it out.
That's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what else are you going to do? Like, you're going to sink, you know, hours and hours and hours of time into finding that little thing. I mean, unless it's causing massive like runtime issues, I suppose. Like, if you can just kick over a server and no one's really going to notice, it's some money saved, I suppose, because you're not dropping hours into it. I don't know. But
it's kind of like the Netflix has their monkey wrench, or what is that called? Chaos Monkey. Where they... it's a utility they have that's open sourced, where it basically will just go and randomly kill things in your infrastructure only during business hours.
What?
And it's supposed to be... they use it at Netflix, but basically, yeah, it'll go and just destroy random things or shut them down. And
randomly terminates virtual machine instances and containers that run inside your production environment, exposing engineers to failures more frequently incentivizes them to build resilient services. Okay. I mean, yeah.
It's literally like pointing a revolver at your head and spinning the chamber, right?
So is that what's been happening? I wonder if like Twitter, Reddit, and Stripe all implemented this last couple of weeks.
They must have.
Because they've all had downtime recently, right? Yeah. Something kicked over a container. That's wild. I don't know. So I've been digging into this Elixir in Action book more. I picked it up after you recommended it to me, and I'm only a few chapters in, but it's so information dense. Like, reading through it, even just going over like the basic language features, you know, special forms, and talking about macros, and even just the data types, I was like, I didn't know that, or I forgot about that, or just like lots of small nuanced things, and It's interesting. Like, almost as soon as you crack the book open, it's like you can't separate Elixir from resilient and what's the other word I'm looking for? Resilient and yeah, I guess resilient, right? Like uptime. What's the word that typically is used with Elixir and Erlang besides resilient?
Fault tolerant.
Yes. So it's like chapter one talking about data types, like resiliency and fault tolerance right out of the gate. And I think it even talked about, I guess it was because it was introducing like the concept of a mutable state and why, kind of explaining a little bit of why like mutable state's a bad thing. And what the example that they gave is, you know, that's why, did you turn it off and turn it back on? Did that work? That's why that's one of the most prominent, like that usually works for a lot of systems because it resets state to a known good state.
It's a really good point. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but of course that the whole reason that things go wrong is because they get mutated into some bad state.
Yeah, it's interesting
whether you realize it or not.
It's I'm thankful that I haven't had to deal with a lot of that stuff yet, that I haven't had to really jump into OTP. I've been really busy just building basic web stuff. Like the stuff that I'm doing now, I could do with any other language, right? I've mentioned before, the functional nature of Elixir just sits well with me. Designing apps with Phoenix, domain-driven design and having boundaries and stuff, that sits really well with me. So it works really well. And so now I'm finally digging into this book. I feel like I've been at like an intermediate Elixir level for a long time now, and I haven't really hopped over to like the deeper end. And now I think like this is starting to kick me into that side of things, which is cool. But yeah, so I've actually been thinking about this stuff a little bit recently, like how can I use this at Design Collective? Do we need to be using it at Design Collective yet? Can it improve stuff? So it's interesting. I was reading about that. Actually, I think it was yesterday, about the fault tolerance, about resetting, you know, like mutable state, resetting it to a known state by turning it off and turning it back on again, solving so many problems.
Well, I mean, you are using all those features. You're just not realizing it because they're all under the hood, right? Phoenix and everything that's built on top of Ecto and Cowboy, the web server, like all that stuff is kind of handled for you, right? So every request that comes into Phoenix or into Cowboy really is a new process, right? And if something goes wrong with that process, it's not going to cause your whole server to reboot or restart, right? Because it's just that one process that died, because it's in a supervised, and your database is a pool of has a pool of connections, and if one of those times out or has an error, it's not going to affect the other ones. And
yeah, I mean, I guess it's a
you kind of get all that stuff for free, and then on top of that, you can build all your boring business logic, right?
Yeah, I think one of the neatest things actually is having access to task, like async tasks with the task module. We've been using that a lot. And in most cases, it just works really well. Simple, easy tool to reach for, you know. But I guess, I mean, that's a lot of what we've discussed previously, too, is don't try to overcomplicate things. And so I've been talking about, you know, replacing coherence. I haven't actually got this live yet because just been busy. But it's like every other auth solution I was looking at had really tried to like take advantage of OOTP things, whether it's like ETS or Amnesia or something similar. And so the argument is like, okay, so if you say you store tokens in a database, well, that means every request that hits your server has at least one plus queries, right? So if I'm asking for product data and that hits GraphQL and I'm storing my auth token in the server, that's an auth token request plus the other requests I need to get my data back, right? And it seems like most of these other libraries, out of the box, they ship with like I was saying, ETS, so they might store tokens in basically in-state memory by default, which is neat, but I haven't needed that yet. I probably won't need that for a while, you know? So I've kind of like dodged a lot of these things so far because I was like, oh, I don't need that. Actually, I'm just going to do my own thing for this auth when I'm pulling coherence out and just rely on... We don't have the scale right now to have to deal with the issue where we need to actually store tokens in memory to skip that database lookup.
Yeah, I don't remember if we talked about this really previously, but a lot of those auth libraries have a lot of, man, they are really over-engineered for what most people need or are trying to accomplish. And I see it a couple times a week in the Elixir Slack, someone talking about Guardian and JWTs and how you shouldn't use JWTs for sessions and Phoenix token and why do you use JWTs if you're just gonna end up looking up in the database anyways and how do you invalidate them and APIs versus the web versus WebSockets and tying that all together. And it's like it doesn't have to be that complicated. You don't have to have a library that does all those things in a weird over-engineered way. It's just functions, man. Just functions.
So I think I have an idea of what you're going to say about this, but when you mention that sort of stuff, so you mentioned, so you have users that are signing in, you might have a token for that. Then maybe you have to support like API requests, right? So then you might want to generate an API token for people. So basically you have a bunch of different situations in different ways people are authenticating into your app. What do you think about sort of centralized solutions like Auth0 or Stormpath or similar, where basically you're offloading all of your authorization or not authorization, but authentication and stuff to a third party and then letting them handle all that stuff?
You know, it's a good question. Now, I don't have any personal experience implementing those types of systems or even single sign-on or anything like that. But I do use a service that uses Auth0. And in their case, it's kind of like the perfect win. So what it is this radio that we're using. It's called the Flex Radio. And it has this feature that basically lets you to log in and access all your radios remotely. Like you register them and then it ties into your account and you just have to log in and all your radios just show up. And it's just a username and password, right? It's all you need. But they didn't have to build that system, right? They're radio designers. They're not they're not web developers, right?
Right.
They did all these like crazy TCP and UDP protocols and leveraging all these standards and stuff, but they're not web guys. They're you know, Windows, C Sharp, and RF engineers. Like, so for them, it was like a perfect application for that. They could just basically with no work get all these advantages and spin up, you know, have this user base basically for no effort, right? So I think that is a very good use case, and I would argue that even early stage applications, like it's I don't know if it's like, I was gonna say it's easy to do that for like an application if you just don't know if it's gonna go anywhere or you just need something easy, but then like if you're building that kind of application, do you even build the auth first? Probably not. You probably build the application first and figure out the auth later. So I don't know. I think they have value. I don't know if I would ever personally go for something like that unless I really needed like all the features that offered, the single sign-on and stuff, and I didn't want to do that myself. But
yeah, I mean, so I asked that because it's something I've been considering a little bit here and there, because, you know, thinking about pulling out coherence and also having some more recent discussions we've had, Design Collective, sort of like tangential businesses that kind of bolt on to Design Collective. So it's not really like a single sign-on sort of situation, but it's sort of like a, if you're a main, I don't know, if you're a store in Design Collective, then you also have access to this other thing, which is separate, but not in a way, if that even makes any sense. But I think the point that you made about, you said, okay, if you have an idea and you're just building something up really quickly, you probably shouldn't even approach the auth stuff first, because that's always sort of a time sink. Even if you're using kind of an off-the-wall solution, it's a time sink. And it's really interesting because I hadn't really thought about bootstrapping like a side project, just building the business, you know, like kind of solving the business case and just like pushing auth to a provider that handles all things auth. But it sounds pretty compelling. I don't know about any downsides because I haven't tried it firsthand. I guess the main downside is that you don't inherently own your stuff, your data, right? Because it's on their servers. The other downside is that I think the billing is usually you pay per number of users that you have. And so I guess depending on what, you know, what your users, like what you make per user, depending on if like someone's paying you $5 a month, $1 a month, or $300 a month, you know what I mean? The payoff could be different there. But the idea that like of removing that complexity or, you know, moving it somewhere else and allowing you to spend time thinking about just the business stuff is pretty compelling to me.
Plus you also get the advantage of new sign-on technologies and strategies that they might come up with. For example, sign-on with Apple is coming in the fall, and it's probably going to be pretty easy to implement, but it'd be cool if you just did nothing and it just showed up for people.
Right, yeah. That and, you know, some people have mentioned to me more recently social logins, also like two-factor authentication as well. It seems like most of them handle that.
Yeah, that's a big one.
You know what I mean? So,
yep.
So really, I mean, you offload your stuff to that and then you just get a token back, and then based off of that, I guess it's like the idea of, I used to have, when I first started web apps, I used to think of like a users as like a users table. So a users table contained an encrypted password as well as their email address, as well as a username, for example. And to me, this just seems like splitting the users table into users and credentials almost, right? And then your credential tables are basically stored in Auth0, and then your user profile information is kept with you.
I've actually seen it also architected and probably over-architected where there's a like users or an accounts table, and then there's a separate logins table.
Mm-hmm.
And the logins table is just for credentials. And then it's, you know, has a foreign key relationship to your actual account. And the account just has, you know, businessy stuff on it.
Right. Yeah. I guess that's a kind of what I'm getting at with that too, is one is basically just user information. The other one's how they are authenticating with your system. And it's interesting. I don't know. It's interesting to think about. I'm now staring at the Auth0 page and thinking, and maybe I shouldn't be because I have lots of other stuff to do, but I don't know. Something to think about, I guess, you know. I guess I can do some research and play with it and kick it around on a side project. But I was just interested in your thoughts there.
Code Monkey, think maybe manager want to write goddamn login page himself.
So what's been up with you?
You mean what's been down with me? Am I right, guys?
That's not good. You taking part?
Yeah, I'm joining the summer of downtime, as quoted by Gizmodo.
Oh, Cloudflare too. I got to add Cloudflare.
Well, we mentioned Cloudflare a few weeks ago.
Yeah, but I'm putting in the show notes, everyone's down. So now we got Stripe, Reddit, Twitter, Cloudflare. So Cloudflare actually caused, you know, obviously you mentioned me in the morning. You're like, hey, just FYI, I know you're not awake yet, but this is what you're about to wake up to. Luckily, by the time I actually rolled out of bed, it was over and everything was back up. But I did notice actually maybe a week ago, maybe more. So I use Hyperping. Hyperping. Let me double check that. Hyperping.io for just uptime monitoring. And the other night, like I said, a week or two ago, I got blasted with, hey, you're down emails. And it wasn't true as far as I could tell. The site was fine. The app was fine. Everything was fine. All the different services were fine. So I messaged them in and was like, hey, did you guys have any sort of false positives happening? And he said, well, there was like a little blip with Cloudflare. So it was like almost a precursor to the real thing going down.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah. I was really racking my brains because I was checking everything. I was like, nothing seems to be broken. And it wasn't specific to a region either. It was just like across the board, hey, everything's down. So, but it wasn't.
Yeah. So yeah, similar thing happened to me a few times. So last weekend was just, you know, the weekend, 4th of July weekend. I had a couple days off. I had friends down. We were doing stuff. And yeah, occasionally I would get, I think it happened 2 or 3 times, I'd get a notification on my phone from AWS. Hey, like health check failed, right? Stuff's down. So luckily I was home for all of these. So I'd run downstairs, log into the servers. And by the time I even like got into the servers to see what was going on, it was like, it was over. It was done. It's really frustrating. I mean, it's good. You know, things came back up quickly. But yeah, I kept getting these huge CPU spikes. And what I found by going through the Phoenix logs was that we're getting this gigantic floods of GraphQL posts. Like there would be probably 30 or 40 of them on each server. Load balance between 3 servers, mind you, right? So maybe like 100 requests all coming in at once. And just making a grind to a halt, right? Because it wasn't designed to handle that. I mean, they weren't big requests or anything, but they were just starving the database pool and causing things to time out. So
yeah,
that was no good. And yeah, and I'm still not 100% sure why this is happening. I have some theories, which I'll get to in a little bit. But so I kind of just stayed on top of it all weekend because I didn't really have time to try to investigate it. I was hoping it wouldn't happen too much. Then first thing Monday, what I did was I played around with the logger metadata in Elixir because I have Phoenix running as the web server. I don't have it behind like Nginx or anything like that. So I didn't have any other logs besides what Phoenix gives you. And
by default,
Phoenix in production doesn't give you a lot. It gives you some response times, tells the requests that come in, obviously any errors, but like it doesn't tell you the IP address or anything like that. So I added that metadata to the logger so it pulls in the remote IP off of the con, which I'm already decoding using the X forwarding for header, right? Because it's behind a load balancer, so the IP address is already wrong, the remote IP. So you have to rewrite the remote IP to be the correct remote IP from on the other side of the load balancer, setting that to logger metadata. So at least when it first request comes in, or first log line, it says IP equals blah. And then after we authenticate the user, I also set the user ID metadata on that as well. So when the request finishes, I actually see at that point who the user ID was that requested it, which is kind of handy to have for any use, right?
Yeah, we have that. We're using timber.io plug, I guess, to do our logging, to keep track of our logging, our log store, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And they have a plug that you can add to your stack that does all that as well. So they'll add basically user information to the logs. And so when you're in the admin side, you can actually scope all your log searching to specific users or IP addresses or whatever.
Yeah, it's really nice. I got to set up something like that or, you know, set up Sentry on the server or something.
Right. Oh, yeah, that too.
So, yeah. So that at least gave me enough data to act on it and figure out, first of all, was this malicious? Turns out, no, it wasn't. It's just some badly behaving client. And then it kind of trying to figure out how the heck I'm going to fix this. And it turns out it was only coming from handful of users, two or three different users. But yeah, so I haven't actually fixed the problem on the client because I just haven't had time. But what I could do is at least fix the root cause, which is, hey, anyone can basically DDoS the application by just blasting it with requests. Right? I'm not behind Cloudflare. I don't have anything else in front of it except AWS load balancer. So that's a bad place to be. And it's never been a problem up until now. But now it's a problem. So I looked into rate limiters for Phoenix and Plug. And there were two out there. I wasn't really too fond of either of them, especially because, again, like talking about the going back to the auth conversation, I didn't need a ton of features. I just wanted to just throw out requests if they were coming in too quickly. And so that's what I did. I wrote a little rate limiter module. It's 71 lines with comments, so it's probably like 30 lines of code. And it uses a ETS-backed table to just every time a request comes in, it timestamps it and then just checks to make sure that some threshold, you didn't get too many requests within that threshold. And if it does it, there's a little plug that checks that and then it just throws a 429, which is a too many requests error to the client.
Right. That's neat.
And so, of course, it's hard to like test that. I just put it in front of the GraphQL API endpoint, which is where the problem was occurring. And then I checked it. I went to bed and checked it the next day. Sure enough, my log was full of 429 responses. And guess what? They all rendered in like 200 microseconds.
Oh, that's the screenshot you sent me because I had no idea what you were trying to say to me, but it was still early in the morning. I was like, cool.
Yeah. So instead of clogging up my connection pool and starving my server resources, it responded in under a millisecond.
Yeah. So the first rate limiter I found for Elixir was Hammer, for Plug actually. And yeah, it has adapters for Redis, Ets, and Amnesia, of course. Like you said, just overkill for what you or I would probably ever need. So question, how does, and you probably don't have an answer to this, but how does a client get into a bad state like that where it's just bombing you with requests?
I haven't had time to look into it, but I have a theory. And the theory involves JavaScript's set interval method function. Okay. So there is some GraphQL polling that goes on in the background. Maybe every 10 seconds or so, each client does a little poll. And they're mostly small responses. You know, mostly they're empty responses. But I think what's happening is something's going on with the browser. Maybe the computer gets CPU bound. Maybe they switch tabs. And like it slows down the clock, which I know some browser tabs are known to do. So like they'll slow down the timer so they don't fire as frequently. Maybe the OS is going to sleep or hibernate or something is causing the browser's timer to suspend. And then when they go back to it, for some reason decides, hey, I want to fire off all those timers that I missed.
Right. Okay.
And then I think it's just blasting them out. That's my best guess so far because, again, it's only coming from a small handful of users. They're all running current versions of Chrome and stuff, Chrome 74, Chrome 75, both on Windows, you know, Windows 7, Windows 8.1. So there's not really a common thread between what's going on yet, but that's my best guess.
Still, though, that's pretty cool that you're just able to, not that you wouldn't with other languages, but, you know, put something together and just toss it out. I really, really like Plug a lot as a concept, as a library. I like it. I like it a lot. I don't know. It's one of my favorite patterns to follow. It's like if you have a problem to solve, especially if it's like a Phoenix thing or if it's like a web kind of layer thing like this, just throw a plug in there and it usually is exactly what you needed.
Yeah, the whole middleware composable request pipeline thing is it's just so extensible. I mean, you can just do anything you need with that.
Yeah, I've been thinking about, because I've been working on refactoring a bunch of Elixir stuff still. And I've been thinking about in a couple of places with our GraphQL endpoint, I have some sort of, I guess it's like a pseudo middle layer right now. It's not really like in a middle layer that it's run on every request, but it's just a module that hangs out. And it's actually bolted onto Bodyguard. So I have policy modules that authorize actions, essentially. And then at the end of the policy modules, I just added a few functions or added my own behavior that I can use that allows me to basically check or authorize individual parameters that are sent to GraphQL. So for example, if you're searching for stores and you're not an admin, you can't search for stores that haven't been approved yet, for example. So when you make a request, the parameters are run through that. It checks to see what type of user you are. And if you're not an admin, it'll just take that parameter out of the request and then continue on. And to me, that feels like it's really repetitive, obviously, to have to like remember to, in every one of your resolvers, run your params through that. That's error prone. So I think that's kind of a perfect use case for an absinthe resolver. And I haven't made one yet, so I think that's probably my first one.
And absinthe itself has middleware as well, so you can even plug stuff in there if you really needed to.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. There's a lot of, so as I look at the code, there's so much duplicated code, which is fine for now, but I think we're at that phase where I can start removing some of the duplicated code, some of the duplicated filters. And I think I was telling you earlier today, I made my own sort of macro, I guess. I don't know what to call it, but basically it wraps that pattern. I guess it's similar to the Inquisitor library, which I'll put a link to the show notes. But basically with Elixir and Ecto, you have this pattern where you can take a map and you reduce the map into an Ecto query, right? And so you can look at the map and say, if the key is title, then do an Ecto query where title I like value or something like that. Something simple, right? So I basically just wrap that up in a nice little module, and then you can use that in a different module, and then you can just define build query 3 in there as many times as you want, and it works really well. And so basically I just need to go through and like replace a bunch of repetitive code with things like that.
So you've got a note here in the show notes that says refactoring a lot, things are spread out, I'm unifying them again.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about that. What's been going on over there in Refactor Friday land?
Refactor half of the week land?
Refactor every day.
Well, not recently because I've been on another project. But yeah, so it's like the namespacing I think we talked about a couple of weeks ago, right? Like manage, marketplace.manage.products or marketplace.browse.products. It's a little bit like, I think, I don't know how long ago we talked about this, but so when I first started splitting things up like that, I think the consensus, even if you look on the Elixir forum right now, the consensus advice is to have each context be responsible for defining its own schema structs, its own Ecto structs, right? So if you follow that advice, if you have marketplace.browse.products, marketplace.browse.products, marketplace.browse will define the product schema that it has access to, the fields that it has access to, and all that stuff, right? Following?
Yeah, we talked about this where, yeah, you can split up a table, a single underlying SQL table, into multiple Ecto schemas depending on the context.
And that's cool until you get a whole bunch of context. So if I'm looking at Design Collective, and we have marketplace, we have blog posts, we have portfolio pieces, we have orders, we have cart, we have coupons, we have just so many more things. I can't even think about them all right now, right? And so if you have marketplace manage and browse stores, then you have two store schemas. And then if you have, say, coupons, and they have to interact with the source table somehow because they belong to stores, then you have to define it there again. And then let's say you have the module that's responsible for building our Google Shopping feed. Well, then you have to define stores, the store schema in there again. Okay, so then you go through and do all that, and then suddenly you have to change column or add a column or remove a column or something, right? And yeah, theoretically, it's simple find and replace, but it's a real pain to maintain over time. So essentially what we did, and we've talked about this before, is I took all of my schemas and moved them into one data namespace. So data.store, and every one of the other contexts uses data.store. And that's worked out really, really well. I haven't had any real issues with like bloat, or, you know, if I need to be really specific with the columns I'm selecting, I'll just do that when I do repo.all or something, right? That's worked out really well. So if you follow that train of thought along, I've had like different filter modules, like so manage and browse. There might be a search functionality in the UI that would duplicate, you know, like where name I like something in both manage and browse. So if that's happening and then you spread out the context some more, you just have lots of kind of repetitive things that are essentially doing the same thing, right? So what I'm trying to do is notice the places where they're pretty much practically the same and just kind of simplifying them into a spot. So maybe there could be like, I don't know, a scopes namespace or something. That's probably a bad idea just thinking off the top of my head, but that's essentially what I'm working on, is taking this code that's duplicated and it's not necessarily causing any problems. There's just a lot of it. It's a lot to handle and a lot to think about when maintaining, especially for one person. So as much as I can take the stuff that is not dangerous, and by that I mean I'm not trying to do a big refactor of like ordering or purchasing or anything like that, but just the stuff like the plumbing, I guess, that's kind of duplicated, I'm trying to merge that back into a smaller surface area.
In general, do you have a lot of copy-pasted, you know, similar lines of code, or do you try to dry things up as quickly as possible?
So I have a lot of copy-pasted code, but the thing is, it's not like the thing is copied and pasted into 10 different places. It's that there's just so much, like DK is big, and so there might be patterns that I can extract, like maybe macros I can extract or functions that I can extract and reuse them elsewhere. I think that's really what I'm after, is trying to find those things that are like, that can be abstracted. So basically I've been too scared, I think, to prematurely abstract a construct. So I just didn't at all. And so that's what I'm trying to like do it carefully now, as opposed to just growing things how they are currently.
Yeah. So just to be clear, I wasn't asking that to, as a, like to shun you or whatever. Like I was generally curious because,
oh, sure, no,
I think that does happen a lot, is it's, if you, as soon as you see the same pattern or chunk of code in two different places, your brain is suddenly, the gears start turning. Oh, what's the abstraction here? How can I abstract this away? And if you do that prematurely, you get the wrong abstraction. You can very easily spend time writing something that is not even a good fit for the problem you're trying to solve. And so we were having this discussion in the Elixir Slack the other day. One of the guys in here who's very well respected and regarded was like, oh yeah, I just copy and paste like a madman and I just clean it up later. And I think that's a totally valid approach, right? You know, you can always delete code, right?
Sure, yeah.
But in the moment, if you don't really immediately know what the right thing to do is, it's probably not worth spending time on.
Yeah, I think really what I'm trying to do is just clean things up. So again, it also stems from the project originally being like not having API, now has an API, and so things are kind of like in a middle state in some places. Like assuming some modules are built assuming that it's not like an API, like a generalized API thing, I guess. That's why I mentioned like using namespaces, as using a namespace to separate functionality as opposed to using some sort of like parameter authorized, like I mentioned, or using bodyguard, like a policy, like I mentioned. But really, I think what the problem is that, yeah, I could continue going this route and it's not hard to figure out. It's not causing me problems. And I don't think it would cause someone else problems coming in to try and learn it. It's just that it's difficult to maintain as one person because it's spread out so much. It's not a hard thing to work with. It's just a time thing to work with, I guess, maybe is what I'm trying to say. And I don't know. I'm just trying to make it easier on myself in doing that. And I think the other thing is that I think for the majority of the project, I mean, Paul is with us for a little over a year, I think. But for the majority of the project, it's just been me. And so I'll make an abstraction that works well, and then I'll forget about it. And so I'll go and implement something else somewhere else that could have used it, but I just forgot that this other thing existed, or I forgot this module existed. And so there's some of that too. So like I forgot completely about the macro that I made for wrapping up the ecto, the map reducing to one ecto query. I forgot that was even in there. And I was like, oh yeah, this exists already. Let me actually just redo what I just did and use this instead, you know? So I think it's just a lot of cleanup stuff that's happening.
Yeah, I love when going through your old code and you're like, oh, that was actually pretty clever. That was a pretty nice design. Pat yourself on the back. And
yeah, it just works. It works great. I was actually really happy today though, because so we have a content writer coming on to the team as a contract role, And so stores can author their own blog posts for SEO reasons and otherwise, I guess. And so we also offer a service where we just help them. If they're busy, then we can help them produce content for their store. We just kind of work with them. And so this person's coming on, and instead of me giving them admin privileges to access every store on the site, because basically they'd have to go to, if they're working with store A and they're going to write a blog post for store A, they sign into the admin, and then they would go to that store A admin's store admin area, right? And then they would have to go to the blog section. But then originally DK's permission system set up, but it was very, very, very limited. So I'm not in a place where right now I can just simply go in and add more granular authentication. But so what I'm doing instead is I'm just building one page in the admin where this content writer can go to that one page and they can author blog posts for the stores that they're allowed to work with. And so that saves them time because they don't have to jump around to different store admins and things like that. And it's all in a central location. They just go to that page. They can do what they need right there.
You could even make a... I mean, this is kind of a... what's the word? It says the... Let me start that over. I'm sorry. You know what you could do is you've got your marketplace browse and your marketplace admin, right? As your two main namespaces.
Mm-hmm.
You could also have the marketplace author. Just,
oh God.
And just add a new top level, to add a new namespace for each new role that comes on there and just add the auth rules in there as opposed to adding granular roles. And I mean, I guess that kind of leads itself to sprawling code, but just a thought.
Well, that and it's using the API. So it's just using the GraphQL endpoint to get blog posts and search for blog posts and stuff. So then I would have to make a separate query for... I just have to make a new query that person would be able to hit. And instead, what I'm doing is just letting them use the regular search endpoint. And I think what I'm going to do is just make one new role and then grant that one new role access to that page in the dashboard in the DK admin. And that way they're still able, that way I don't have to make any big changes. So really the only changes I had to make to the server for this to work is the role change. But aside from that, it was just adding a couple of filters that they need to be searched by. Because up until now, we haven't had a need for people to be able to search for blog posts by title, for example, or search for blog posts that belong to a store by name or something like that. So I literally added two Ecto queries in my built query setup, and the page was ready to go. Like the API was ready to go. Then I just started building the dashboard page in the view side of things. So that was I guess that's what I'm getting at. Like, yeah, I could spread it out more and add more queries, but I think what's easier for me now is to just add the authorization levels in the middle and let them access data like everyone else accesses data.
Yeah, because otherwise you end up going in the other direction where things start getting more spread out again.
Yeah. Now, if I were doing like the traditional server-side rendered app, 100%, I would just do the easiest thing, right? But yeah, since it's an API, and we've had other discussions too, like, do we open the API up for stores to use? Because some stores are they have like a tech employee that helps run their website. And so, you know, if they're able to figure something out, they could use our API to push and update products for their stores as opposed to using the web, right? A few of our stores have people that do that. They've already automated inventory getting pushed to other places. So, you know, for us, it's just another feature that already exists that they could use, which is why I brought up the API token thing earlier. But yeah, so really everything's just moving more towards an API. Like the newer features we're offering, like API, you know, it's kind of departing from the original setup. So that's why things are kind of in flux, I suppose, and how I would have approached the problem before and how I'm approaching it now.
It's interesting to see how all those decisions you made seemed like so long ago with, you know, picking the technologies and Vue and GraphQL and Phoenix and stuff, and how it's really starting to pay dividends now.
Oh, GraphQL, like Absinthe has been awesome. It's been really awesome. So like I said, adding those new filters, I added the Ecto queries and then updated the blog filter or blog post filter type in GraphQL. And we're done. Like now anyone one of the UIs could use that if they needed to. If Nick wanted to rebuild something, he could, and it's just there available. And it's documented because just adding, I love in Absinthe how you can just add describe to almost anything, any field type, and you have documentation in the browser for anyone to use. It's awesome. So that's been a huge boost to me. I think really, if I'm kicking, and I'm not really kicking myself, but if I'm kicking myself for anything, it's not using middleware earlier, because most of these problems, say the multiple namespaces being spread out, and kind of copying, pasting param authorizations and stuff being spread out, has because I think I was just needed to get something done, so I just copied and pasted. And really, like, if I would have just set up a middleware first and gone that route, I wouldn't need to do most of this stuff. But that's how you learn, I suppose.
Yep.
It's also interesting now that I think about it. So I need to get around to writing a blog post I talked to you about. I wanted to write a post that kind of breaks down the basics of web apps, like middleware, plugins.
All the building blocks.
Just things that every web app has, like sessions and cookies and just kind of explain, like, here are the major moving pieces to basically every web app, and kind of describe them. Because now that I think about it, like, if I'm thinking about the front end, which for whatever reason my brain always feels more comfortable with, if I'm thinking about Nuxt, modules, and plugins, that's what Design Collective at the core is. Like, all the complicated stuff are in modules and plugins and Nuxt, you know? So, it, to me, the server-side stuff is always more intimidating because I came from the front-end world, and I don't know how to break that. But now that I think about it, most everything I need to do refactoring-wise is consolidating to a module or adding something to a middleware that's reused automatically. So, yeah. It's funny how that, I don't know. It's like, I always feel like my roots, I've written way more Elixir than JavaScript at this point, but I always still feel like I'm more of a front-end developer for some reason.
Yeah, I'm always coming at things from the other direction, for sure. The front end is my crutch.
I don't know how to break that crutch, but yeah.
Just do it more,
I guess, yeah.
Try new things.
Slow down more. I think that's really, a lot of it too, has just been in a rush, right? Just been in a rush.
Oh yeah, nonstop.
Well, that's all I got for this week.
Well, at least you don't have to have a gen server that periodically kills the process because it runs out of memory. So you got that going for you.
Yeah, I mean, that is very true.
I mean, Heroku did that for a while, but I think that's pretty much solved now, right?
Yeah, it's solved.
Awesome.
Well, cool. I guess it's that time to ask for feedback. And if anyone has any feedback about what I had to say today, please let me know. Any feedback on Rockwell's stuff, please let him know. He did paste a link to his awesome rate limiter. I might actually steal that from him in the show notes. But yeah, we'd appreciate any feedback, any shares, any sort of communication with us. We just love hearing from people.
As always, you can reach us on Twitter, DNC Show. Sean is Sean Washbot, and I am Shrockwell.
As I've mentioned numerous times in this episode, we have a bunch of show notes from today's links and things we talked about. So if you want to see those, head on over to dnc.show, and they'll be on the first rectangle on the top left when you go to dnc.show.
The first rectangle. Is that a designer term?
Not sure. I was envisioning it in my head, and that's what it was. Yep, it's first rectangle, top left. I just looked at it.
It's above the fold.
Yes, it is.
We'll also post show notes over on spectrum.chat, where you can come say hi. As much communities over there for development, design, workplace, workflows and life hacks and all that good stuff. Head on over to spectrum.chat. Come and say hi.
And thanks as always to Spec for having us and putting up with us. And thanks to Mikhail for listening to us every week and giving his feedback. He usually makes fun of me for stuff. But yeah, thanks to Spec for having us. And if you're interested in other design and developer related shows, head on over to spec.fm to see what's going on over there.
Mikhail never gives me a hard time. I must be doing something right.
You're probably more intimidating.
I don't think so. This week's episode of Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport and produced by Sarah Jackson.
All right, I'll talk to you later.
See you, man.